Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Emerson Green. Say that you believed that conscious thought is a function of the brain. Would you then be rationally compelled to disbelieve in the afterlife? William James argues no. In his Ingersoll Lecture on Immortality, William James outlined a potential theory of consciousness, one that is consistent with the hope of an afterlife and doesn't subvert what we've learned from the scientific study of the brain. Although widely neglected, I've occasionally heard this view or something like it out in the wild from those trying to explain consciousness and its relationship with the physical world. Recently, it's been discussed by philosopher of religion Paul Draper. Like James, Draper doesn't actively endorse this theory, but rather sees it as a valid and under-discussed option that should be considered alongside the more common views. In a nutshell, etherism sees the brain as more of a receiver, not a producer of consciousness. The brain is not identical with the mind any more than the radio is identical with the song it plays. Of course, if you damage the radio, you will notice changes in the music. But it's a bad inference to then say that the song is produced by the radio, or just is the radio, or is another concept co-referring to the radio, etc. There's a lot more to etherism than that, and the radio isn't a perfect analogy, but I didn't want to keep you in suspense. That's the gist of it. So this view accounts for why there are tight correlations with mind and brain, but also why they seem to be conceptually distinct, and arguably, ontologically distinct. So it's a pretty attractive position. So why was William James thinking about this? In his lecture on immortality, he referred to scientifically cultivated circles who, even in 1898, commonly believed in the, quote, absolute dependence of consciousness upon the brain. This is not a new belief that only arrived after late 20th century neuroscience. Quote, one hears not only physiologists, but numbers of laymen who read the popular science books and magazines, saying all about us, how can we believe in life hereafter when science has once and for all attained to proving, beyond possibility of escape, that our inner life is a function of that famous material, the so-called gray matter of our cerebral convolutions? How can the function possibly persist after its organ has undergone decay? Thus, physiological psychology is what is supposed to bar the way to the old faith, and it is now, as a physiological psychologist, that I ask you to look at the question with me a little more closely. It is indeed true that physiological science has come to the conclusion cited, and we must confess that in doing so, she's only carried out a little farther the common belief of mankind. Everyone knows that arrests of brain development occasion imbecility, that blows to the head abolish memory or consciousness, and that brain stimulants and poisons change the quality of our ideas. The anatomists, physiologists, and pathologists have only shown this generally admitted fact of a dependence to be detailed and minute. End quote. That was the intellectual zeitgeist in 1898, which I emphasize because there's a strange tendency to treat mind-brain dependence as a fact that no one knew about until relatively recently. It's not as if the medievals didn't know that if a donkey kicked you in the head, your memory or cognition might suffer. As James rightly says, contemporary neuroscience has shown this generally acknowledged fact of correlation in increasingly minute detail. Just look at how James is addressing the audience. He cites it as if it's common knowledge. We all know this. Everyone who reads science publications knows this. Quote, for the purposes of my argument now, I wish to adopt this general doctrine as if it were established absolutely, with no possibility of restriction. So I beg you to agree with me today in subscribing to the great psychophysiological formula. Thought is a function of the brain. End quote. The word function is a bit more of a loaded term in today's context than it was in his, since functionalism was and is a major school of thought in philosophy of mind that's undergone a lot of development in the 20th century. But I think the gist of what he's trying to say is clear enough. So, he asks, if we accept the great psychophysiological formula, should we be rationally compelled to disbelieve in an afterlife? Quote, the question is then, does this doctrine logically compel us to disbelieve in immortality? Ought it force every truly consistent thinker to sacrifice his hopes of a hereafter to what he takes to be his duty of accepting all the consequences of a scientific truth? Most persons imbued with what one may call the Puritanism of science would feel themselves bound to answer this question with a yes. The next thing in order for me is to try to make it plain to you why I believe that it has in strict logic no deterrent power. It is not at all impossible, but on the contrary quite possible, that life may still continue when the brain itself is dead. First, he argues that functions come in different varieties. If thought is a function of the brain, is interpreted along the same lines as steam is a function of the tea kettle or light is a function of the electric current, then in that case, he concedes, consciousness cannot continue after the death of the brain. Quote, of course, if such production be the function, then when the organ perishes, since the production can no longer continue, the soul must surely die. Such a conclusion as this is indeed inevitable from that particular conception of the facts. End quote. But productive function isn't the only kind of function. There's also what James calls releasing or permissive function, as well as transmissive function. The trigger of a crossbow, he says, is an example of the former, a releasing function. It removes the obstacle that holds the string. He also gives the example of a hammer falling upon a detonator. He offers, as a case of transmissive function, a refracting lens or prism. And this is closer to how James views the mind. Quote, the energy of light, no matter how produced, is by the glass sifted and limited in color, and by the lens or prism determined to a certain path and shape. Similarly, the keys of an organ have only a transmissive function. They open successively the various pipes and let the wind in the air chest escape in various ways. The voices of the various pipes are constituted by the columns of air trembling as they emerge. But the air is not engendered in the organ. The organ proper, as distinguished from its air chest, is only an apparatus for letting portions of it loose upon the world in these peculiarly limited shapes. We'll talk about Paul Draper's explanation of etherism in more detail in a moment, but I think in order to understand what James is talking about, it would be useful to quote Draper at this point. Quote, James doesn't deny that thought is a function of the brain. He just denies that the function in question is one of production. In other words, he suggests a corrective answer to the hard problem of consciousness instead of a direct answer. How does the brain produce the mind? It doesn't. Instead, mentality exists quite independently of the brain. Consider an analogy. Like other living things, our bodies make use of sunlight. Indeed, they have evolved to make use of it in very complicated ways. Sunlight is a sort of electromagnetic radiation. Human bodies are immersed in it, but not composed of it. Similarly, perhaps the brain makes use of a consciousness that already exists, independently of the existence of brains or nervous systems. On this view, human organisms are immersed in a sort of conscious ether that they've evolved to use in very complicated ways, but they are not composed of that ether. Let's call this view psychological ether theory, or just etherism for short. On this view, while all concrete stuff is physical in the sense that it is either space or located in space, so a sort of monism is true, not all of it is material. It's not all composed of or identical to fundamental particles like quarks and electrons. In addition to those entities, there is an omnipresent mind, a world soul, or mental ether, if you will, that can interact with the material world, and in particular with the nervous systems of human beings and some other animals. Etherism appears to add a fifth fundamental interaction to gravitation, electromagnetism, and the strong and weak interactions. This is indeed costly. There are no free lunches here. But is that any more absurd than denying that robust consciousness exists, or asserting that quarks are robustly conscious, or claiming that a new sort of stuff emerges from nothing when matter is organized in a certain way? It seems not. End quote. So, when it's stated that thought is a function of the brain, it's usually interpreted to mean productive function, but as James argues, this isn't the only type of function. Quote, as I said then, the fatal consequence is not coercive, the conclusion which materialism draws being due solely to its one-sided way of taking the word function. And whether we care or not for immortality in itself, we ought, as mere critics doing police duty among the vagaries of mankind, to insist on the illogicality of a denial based on the flat ignoring of a palpable alternative. How much more we ought to insist as lovers of truth when the denial is that of such a vital hope to mankind? In strict logic, then, the fangs of cerebralistic materialism are drawn. My words ought consequently already to exert a releasing function on your hopes. You may believe, henceforward, whether you care to profit by the permission or not. End quote. So for James, it's not just that materialists are being irrational. They're being irrational, yes, by ignoring certain possibilities compatible with the great psychophysiological formula, but they're being irrational in order to say that there's no hope of an afterlife. If you're going to defend an unhappy truth, that's one thing, but defending an unhappy falsehood is something else. And James doesn't seem to think much of the productive function crowd. He says, quote, "Into the mode of production of steam in a tea kettle, we have conjectural insight, for the terms that change are physically homogeneous with one another, and we can easily imagine the case to consist of nothing but alterations of molecular motion. But in the production of consciousness by the brain, the terms are heterogeneous natures altogether. And as far as our understanding goes, it is as great a miracle as if we said, thought is spontaneously generated, or created out of nothing. The theory of production is therefore not a jot more simple or credible in itself than any other conceivable theory. It is only a little more popular." By contrast, he argues, the position he's defending doesn't require any comparable miracles. Quote, "Consciousness in this process does not have to be generated de novo in a vast number of places. It exists already, behind the scenes, coeval with the world." End quote. In addition to this purported theoretical advantage, James adds a consideration that few contemporary philosophers would be willing to entertain. Psi phenomena. Quote, "The transmission theory also puts itself in touch with a whole class of experiences that are with difficulty explained by the production theory. I refer to those obscure and exceptional phenomena reported at all times throughout human history." And he names among these, quote, "instantaneous healings, premonitions, apparitions at times of death, clairvoyant visions or impressions, and other phenomena." If all our human thought be a function of the brain, then, of course, if any of these things are facts, and to my own mind some of them are facts, we may not suppose that they can occur without preliminary brain action. But in the mysterious phenomena to which I allude, it is often hard to see where the sense organs can come in. On the production theory, one does not see from what sensations such odd bits of knowledge are produced. On the transmission theory, they don't have to be produced. They exist ready-made in the transcendental world, and all that's needed is an abnormal lowering of the brain threshold to let them through. In cases of conversion, in providential leadings, sudden mental healings, etc., it seems to the subjects themselves of the experience as if a power from without, quite different from the ordinary action of the senses or of the sense-led mind, came into their life, as if the latter suddenly opened into that greater life in which it has its source. The word influx well describes this impression of new insight, or new willingness, sweeping over us like a tide. All such experiences, quite paradoxical and meaningless on the production theory, fall very naturally into place on the other theory. We need only suppose the continuity of our consciousness with a mother sea to allow for exceptional waves occasionally pouring over the dam. End quote. He quickly adds, it should be noted, that while he takes this to be an advantage of the transmission theory, it's, quote, "an advantage which I am well aware that some of you will not rate very high." He also invokes Kant, who says, quote, "the body would thus not be the cause of our thinking, but merely a condition restrictive thereof, and although essential to our sensuous and animal consciousness, it may be regarded as an impeder of our pure spiritual life." End quote. James takes this to be fairly close to his transmissive theory. He then raises the question, although it's treated as an objection, of an animal afterlife. If we think that human beings can survive death, then what about our primate ancestors? What about current primates? What about every animal and creeping thing that ever showed a flicker of consciousness? He confesses that he initially balked at the thought of an afterlife for all conscious beings, but he goes on to dismiss that prejudice. An objection based on incredulity at an overpopulated afterlife is merely, quote, "a sign of human incapacity, a remnant of the old narrow-hearted, aristocratic creed." And I want to read this larger section where he deals with this objection, because I think it's interesting and kind of funny. Quote, "It is the most obvious fallacy in the world, and the only wonder is that all the world should not see through it. It's the result of nothing but an invincible blindness from which we suffer, an insensibility to the significance of alien lives, and a conceit that would project our own capacity into the vast cosmos and measure the wants of the absolute by our own puny needs. Our Christian ancestors dealt with the problem more easily than we do. We indeed lack sympathy, but they had a positive antipathy for these alien human creatures, and they naively supposed the deity to have antipathy too. Being as they were heathen, our forefathers felt a certain sort of joy in thinking that their creator made them as so much mere fuel for the fires of hell. Our culture has humanized us beyond that point, but we cannot yet conceive them as our comrades in the fields of heaven. We have, as the phrase goes, no use for them, and it oppresses us to think of their survival. Take, for instance, all the Chinamen. Which of you here, my friends, see any fitness in their eternal perpetuation unreduced in numbers? Surely not one of you. Surely. At most, you might deem it well to keep a few chosen specimens alive to represent an interesting and peculiar variety of humanity. But as for the rest, God himself, you think, can have no use for them. An immortality of every separate specimen must be to him, and to the universe, as indigestible a load to carry as it is to you. This, I am sure, is the attitude of mind of some of you before me. But is not such an attitude due to the various lack and dearth of your imagination? You take these swarms of alien kinsmen as they are for you, an external picture painted on your retina, representing a crowd oppressive by its vastness and confusion. As they are for you, so you think they positively and absolutely are. I feel no call for them, you say, therefore there is no call for them. But all the while, beyond this externality, which is your way of realizing them, they realize themselves with the acutest internality, with the most violent thrills of life. It's you who are dead, stone dead and blind and senseless, in your way of looking on. You open your eyes upon a scene of which you miss the whole significance. Each of these grotesque or even repulsive aliens is animated by an inner joy of living, as hot or hotter than that which you feel beating in your private breast. The sun rises and beauty beams to light his path. To miss the inner joy of him is to miss the whole of him. Not a being of the countless throng is there whose continued life is not called for, and called for intensely, by the consciousness that animates the being's form. That you never realize, nor understand, nor call for it, is an absolutely irrelevant circumstance. That you have a saturation point of interest tells us nothing of the interests that absolutely are. Finally, he concludes, quote, "For my own part, then, so far as logic goes, I am willing that every leaf that ever grew in this world's forests and rustled in the breeze should become immortal. The heart of being can have no exclusions akin to those which our poor little hearts set up." End quote. So I find it fascinating that he dedicated so much time to this objection, if you can call it that. It's nearly 10% of this lecture, the problem of too many Asians in the afterlife. I mean, maybe you can keep one or two as like a specimen, but all of them? So I had to include that. I mean, he was able to rise above the prejudices of his time, as so few are able to do. And in case you can't tell, I have immense respect for William James as a philosopher and a psychologist, but it's just funny to me that any of that had to be said. So the circle has expanded, but today many people similarly balk at the idea of an animal afterlife. Sometimes they even balk at the implications of the idea that animals aren't just robots that we can do anything to for any reason. But back to the main question of etherism itself, you'll notice that if you read the whole paper, he freely uses the term soul, which on the face of it seems to lend support to the idea that James is defending a strange kind of dualism. He clearly takes the mind and body to be ontologically distinct, although intimately connected with one another, as every dualist in history has. He doesn't consider this to be panpsychism, or as he calls it in The Principles of Psychology, the mind stuff theory, which he attributes to W.K. Clifford. So we're going to take a detour to examine note 3 of the lecture, since that clarifies the nature of this position a bit more and how it's distinguished from the alternatives. The footnotes are about as long as the lecture itself, and they're interesting, but we're just going to take a look at note 3. Quote, "The philosophically instructed reader will notice that I have all along been placing myself at the ordinary dualistic point of view of natural science and of common sense. From this point of view, mental facts, like feelings, are made of one kind of stuff or substance, physical facts of another. Now, on the dualistic assumption, one cannot see more than really two different sorts of dependence of our mind on our brain. Either, one, the brain brings into being the very stuff of consciousness of which our mind consists, or else, two, consciousness pre-exists as an entity, and the various brains give to it its various special forms. If supposition two be the true one, and the stuff of mind pre-exists, there are, again, only two ways of conceiving that our brain confers upon it the specifically human form. it may exist A, in disseminated particles, and then our brains are organs of concentration, organs for combining and massing these into resultant minds of personal form, or it may exist B, in vaster unities, absolute world soul, or something less, and then our brains are organs for separating it into parts and giving them finite form. There are thus three possible theories of the brain's function, and no more. We may name them severally. 1. The theory of production. 2a. The theory of combination. And 2b. The theory of separation. In this lecture, theory 2b, specified more particularly as the transmission theory, is defended against theory number 1. Theory 2a, otherwise known as the mind dust or mind stuff theory, is left entirely unnoticed for a lack of time. I also leave it uncriticized in these notes, having already considered it, as fully as the so far published forms of it may seem to call for, in my work The Principles of Psychology. I may say here, however, that Professor W.K. Clifford, one of the ablest champions of the combination theory and originator of the useful term mind stuff, considers that theory incompatible with individual immortality. And now he's quoting Clifford, "The laws connecting consciousness with changes in the brain are very definite and precise, and their necessary consequences are not to be evaded. Consciousness is a complex thing, made up of elements, a stream of feelings. The action of the brain is also a complex thing made up of elements, a stream of nerve messages. For every feeling in consciousness, there is at the same time a nerve message in the brain. Consciousness is not a simple thing, but a complex. It is the combination of feelings into a stream. If individual feeling always goes with individual nerve message, if combination or stream of feelings always goes with stream of nerve messages, does it not follow that, when the stream of nerve messages is broken up, the stream of feelings will be broken up also, will no longer form a consciousness? Does it not follow that when the messages themselves are broken up, the individual feelings will be resolved into still simpler elements?" And this is something that listeners will already be familiar with, but panpsychists typically don't believe in an afterlife. Panpsychism really is just a weird form of materialism. Most of what follows on materialism also follows on panpsychism. Just arguing that consciousness is the intrinsic nature of the brain doesn't somehow leave the door open for consciousness existing independently of the physical world. Okay, so let's move on to Draper's etherism. So you may have noticed that the word etherism doesn't appear in James's lecture. As far as I know, that's a label provided by Paul Draper. Correct me if I'm wrong. Draper's been talking about this idea for the past few years, and I've actually seen him talk about it at two conferences. His views evolved and have been evolving, so don't take this to be the final word on the matter. So here's how Draper summarizes James's view. William James points us in the right direction in his Ingersoll lecture on immortality. His main goal in that lecture was to defend the view that there is life after death against the objection that, since the brain produces the mind, the inevitable permanent destruction of the brain guarantees the permanent destruction of the mind. He attempts to rebut this objection by questioning the objector's assumption that the brain produces the mind. He doesn't deny that thought is a function of the brain, he just denies that the function in question is one of production. In other words, he suggests a corrective answer to the hard problem of consciousness, instead of a direct answer. How does the brain produce the mind? It doesn't. Instead, mentality exists quite independently of the brain. Consider an analogy. Like other living things, our bodies make use of sunlight. Indeed, they have evolved to make use of it in very complicated ways. Sunlight is a sort of electromagnetic radiation. Human bodies are immersed in it, but not composed of it. Similarly, perhaps the brain makes use of a consciousness that already exists, independently of the existence of brains or nervous systems. On this view, human organisms are immersed in a sort of conscious ether that they've evolved to use in very complicated ways, but they are not composed of that ether. Let's call this view psychological ether theory, or just etherism for short. On this view, while all concrete stuff is physical in the sense that it is either space or located in space, so a sort of monism is true, not all of it is material. It's not all composed of or identical to fundamental particles like quarks and electrons. In addition to those entities, there is an omnipresent mind, a world soul, or mental ether, if you will, that can interact with the material world, and in particular with the nervous systems of human beings and some other animals. If such a fundamental immaterial entity exists, then it is also plausible to suppose that, while fundamental material reality has a bottom-up structure, fundamental mental reality has a top-down structure, In other words, in the case of material reality, the properties of the parts explain the properties of the whole, while in the case of mental reality, the properties of the whole explain the properties of the parts. On etherism, consciousness exists and is robust. The mental ether is fundamental, but ordinary material objects are not composed of it, even if they are immersed in it. In addition, precisely because the mental ether is fundamental, consciousness is not emergent. So is this a form of dualism? Draper says no, not if we take dualism to entail the denial of the following premise. Quote, all of the fundamental lower-level stuff of which human beings are composed is ultimately the same sort of stuff as the fundamental lower-level stuff of which ordinary material objects like tables, mountains, and stars are composed. Draper does acknowledge, however, that etherism would suffer from the interaction problem to the same extent as dualism, although in my view the interaction problem isn't a real problem. On the other hand, dualists do not necessarily believe that the mind is located in space, but Draper says the mental ether does exist in space, so that could be one distinction from dualism. Draper also says that, quote, no god is required to create the mental ether. It is a purely natural entity. He adds that since ether is located in space, etherism could qualify as a type of monism, and even physical monism, as long as we take the somewhat narrow view that something is physical if it exists in space. The ether pervades space, so it technically qualifies as physical in that sense. One further consideration, quote, worries about how individual souls get paired with individual bodies do not arise if there is only a single, omnipresent world soul. Nevertheless, Draper is worried about the implausibility of etherism. He laments that, quote, it appears to add a fifth fundamental interaction to gravitation, electromagnetism, and the strong and weak interactions. So he grants that this is a cost of the theory, but he reminds us that there's no such thing as a free lunch. Besides, is it any less plausible than the alternatives? Quote, is etherism any more absurd than denying that robust consciousness exists, or asserting that quarks are robustly conscious, or claiming that a new sort of stuff emerges from nothing when matter is organized in a certain way? It seems not. End quote. Like William James, he considers another line of evidence that, in James's words, is an advantage which I am well aware that some of you will not rate very high. Quote, further, there is, I think, some empirical, though not scientific, evidence for the psychological ether theory, namely that some people seem to perceive that their own minds are a part of a much larger mental reality. Mystics from a variety of religious traditions claim to experience being absorbed into God, like individual drops of water that fall into the ocean, or even being identical to God. Could it be that when they meditate and successfully extinguish or repress all or almost all of the many states of consciousness that ordinarily clutter our mental landscape, they manage to get a glimpse of a larger mental horizon that's normally hidden from view? Keep in mind that many of these mystics have very strong reasons not to blur the distinction between themselves and God, because to do so is heretical in the religious traditions to which they belong. This makes it more likely that how they describe their experiences is accurate. Perhaps then we should take seriously one of the central doctrines of the Vedanta schools of Hindu thought, namely, the doctrine that Atman is Brahman, the individual soul is the world soul. As a philosopher of religion, I'm even tempted to rename etherism panpsychoanentheism, all minds in God-ism, which adds a fourth option to the usual tripartite menu of classical theism, pantheism, and panentheism. Finally, perhaps William James was right to challenge the confidence that most philosophers and scientists have that there is no life after death. For if we don't know that etherism is false, then we don't actually know that the subject of our psychological properties does not continue to exist after our bodies are destroyed. So I have a few thoughts on etherism. While I do think that etherism is arguably a form of dualism, I don't think that's a reason to dislike it as a theory. One could think of it as essentially dualism, except there's only one world soul, rather than innumerable individual souls autonomously roaming the universe. There's only one omnipresent field of consciousness which interacts with each individual physical body. On the other hand, it can feel like a strange form of panpsychism, rather than a strange form of dualism, since one could easily amend etherism on the basis of vagueness arguments to say that this fundamental field of consciousness interacts with all physical particles, not just collections of particles arranged brain-wise. I think one could argue that the pervasive field of consciousness interacts with all matter on grounds of simplicity, non-arbitrariness, and vagueness arguments. So this would be distinct from Russellian panpsychism, which says that consciousness is the intrinsic nature of matter, and could instead be combined with a view on which there is no intrinsic nature of matter at all. So this could potentially open a new route for panpsychism, one that doesn't rest upon contentious metaphysical claims about intrinsic natures, promulgated by Bertrand Russell, Arthur Eddington, and many others. I think that's an interesting possibility. I do lean in favor of Russellian monism, just because I think physics is very abstract, it's very mathematical, so to the extent that we think math abstracts away from the concrete world, we should think physics does the same. It makes sense to me that there would have to be some concrete thing that has the abstract structure that we're talking about when we're doing physics. I don't understand how there could only be math. Like I said, to the extent that we think math abstracts away, we should think physics does also. It makes sense to me that there would have to be some concrete reality that underlies or exemplifies the mathematical gnomic structure that we get from physics. All in all, Draper could be correct that etherism really is a distinct view from the more well-known alternatives. I think it depends on how one fleshes out the theory. But it's an interesting idea, right? The idea that there's a fifth fundamental field. It perfectly accounts for the evidence mounted by materialists and is compatible with non-physicalist arguments like the knowledge argument, conceivability argument, and so on. And not for nothing, it leaves the door open to an afterlife. Your subjective point of view could continue after death, although it would be a quite different form of existence without your physical body mediating and sifting out the beams of consciousness, to use James's prism metaphor. On this view, you're like a drop of the ocean, temporarily bursting over the surface of the waves, and you'll someday soon, return and be reabsorbed by the ocean beneath you. Of course, some will protest and demand some kind of scientific experiment to support etherism, but I think those people are just confused. We have to reason philosophically to get to materialism, or dualism, or etherism. The evidence is radically underdetermined. To work out the relationship between mind and the physical world, you're going to have to reason about it. Talking about this view with a friend, and I don't know how common this pushback would be, but this is what a friend had to say about etherism. Quote, "Unless I missed something, etherism still doesn't really meaningfully solve the hard problem, does it? It sidesteps the issue of why there are first-person subjective experiences by positing that they demerge from the ethereal mind, but it does nothing to suggest why or how phenomenal consciousness exists within the universe at all. It just posits the brute existence of the ether, as far as I can tell." So etherism says that there exists a field along with the other physical fields. So whatever your explanation is of those other fields, that explanation will be available to the etherist. They're just adding one additional field to explain a phenomenon that would otherwise be puzzling without it. This is completely ordinary scientific practice, as David Chalmers has often pointed out. You wouldn't object to Maxwell or Higgs on the ground that they haven't really explained anything, since they've merely posited the existence of a field without also giving a deeper explanation of why it exists. That requirement would lead to an infinite regress, and nothing would ever be accepted as a legitimate explanation. Something similar is sometimes alleged about panpsychism. Well, you haven't explained why fundamental consciousness exists. Yeah, but we have no hard problem of consciousness, and there is no corresponding hard problem of matter, thanks to Russell and Eddington. And it's not as if the physicalist says something about the existence of physical matter itself that wouldn't be available to the panpsychist to say about mind as well. If you want to change the subject to questions about ultimate explanation, then that's fine. But it's not a strike against panpsychism any more than it's a strike against physicalism. You're just asking a different question. Imagine if we did this in any other area. Well, Maxwell, nice job explaining electromagnetism by adding a fundamental field, but you haven't explained why there's something rather than nothing. You've merely posited the brute existence of an EM field. So this is basically not an advancement, if you think about it. Anyway, back to my totally failed theory that also suffers from this so-called problem. As I mentioned, Draper has a lot more to say about etherism. The short paper available online is not the most recent version, and I'm sure he's evolved further since I last heard him speak about it in Oklahoma City. He even identified some ethical advantages of etherism, but for now, that's where we'll leave it. So what do you think about etherism? Let me know in the comments below, and don't forget to smash that like button and the subscribe button. Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.